Thank you, Steph, and thank you everyone for being here. I'm really excited to be here. I've had a really good time. I think my favorite part was probably Juan's takedown of Galactica. I think he should make a YouTube channel or something. So as Steph said, my name's Anna. I was a Psy student here last year, and this term I'm mostly in Boston, working with Quera. And today, I'll actually not tell you so much about what I'm doing there, but about some other recent exciting developments at the company. And also, just as a heads up, this talk is highly non-technical. You know, we're at the end of the conference, so just enjoy the animations. And also a big shout out to the whole team at Quera. They've put in a lot of work recently in hosting a series of webinars. And this talk is basically a condensed version of those webinars. This works. It just buzzed. Is that supposed to happen? Let's see. Maybe there's another in here. I'll give it one more try. Nope. One moment. Let's see whether this can work, because it'll make life a lot easier. And we were so close to a Linux victory. It buzzed. And let's see whether it works in the first place. Oh, maybe that's why it's not working at all. Okay. Hey, okay. So, Quera is a neutral atom quantum computing company based in Boston. And the first thing to really emphasize is that it was born out of a very strong scientific community over there. On the Harvard side, we have Misha Lukin's lab, from which Maddie is visiting us this week. We have Markus Greiner. And on the MIT side, we have Vladan Vlutichik and Dirk Englund. And these are really the people who came up in the first place with this neutral atom architecture. Then Alex, our CEO, he was a grad student in Misha Lukin's lab before co-founding Quera. And Nate, our CTO, he was a professor at Penn State University, also before coming to Boston to be part of Quera. So let's have a little look at the history of the company. Back in November 2017, I'm told, these people we just saw, they were, you know, sitting at Harvard in control of one of the world's largest quantum computers back then, had 51 qubits. And that was really when they first had the idea, the motivation, to not just keep that computer in the lab, but put it out there and make it available, accessible to other research groups as well. And I think that's important to emphasize because that idea has really stuck with the company to this day. We definitely cater to industry as well, but academia is a core part of the target audience. So that includes you too. The first step towards making that a reality was in July 2018, when Quera was officially founded as a spin-off from Harvard and MIT. And the next three are a few milestones along the way. So in July 2021, together with those associated academic labs, the hardware was taken kind of to the next level, control of 256 atoms. That's also the level we're at right now. And then the other two milestones, they really showcase the type of problem that these machines are really good at solving. So here, the one last year, goes more in the direction of condensed matter. These machines are really good at finding special ground states. In this case, It was the very first realization of this mythical quantum spin liquid. Predicted, but never realized in experiment. And then this one over here, February 2022. It's pretty much the work that Maddie was talking about. Again, together with the academic labs, the first demonstration of scaling advantage for optimization problems. That was that maximum independent set problem. But really, the biggest moment happened just a few weeks ago in November. What was it? It was the launch of Aquila, Quera's very first quantum computer. And yeah, no, I can't believe I got to be part of that. You know, it's my very first internship, and I arrive, and they just launched this quantum computer. It was pretty cool. And if there's one takeaway message, then it is that Aquila is online. That's what we mean when we say the launch of Aquila. You at home, you can access this machine, you can send tasks to it, and we'll walk through the steps of how to do that. So what can Aquila do? Or first, let's meet Aquila. What is Aquila? As I said, it has 256 qubits, which is quite significant. It is coherent throughout its computation. What we mean by that is kind of that its coherence time is longer than the D-Wave machines. What about its architecture? Three main points. Firstly, it works in an analog mode. Secondly, we like to call it a field programmable qubit array. And thirdly, its architecture is modular. If you have no clue what I meant with those three terms, then don't worry, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about now. And this, by the way, that's a real picture. I should point here. A real picture of Aquila. It really looks like that. So now, what can Aquila do? We've already seen two areas, and those are two of, let's say, the three main areas that we specialize in. The first one being Hamiltonian simulation. That's both for more equilibrium problems, you know, looking at quantum phases of matter, but also non-equilibrium dynamics. For example, quench dynamics, stuff like this. Also quantum thermalization, and even some stuff for high energy physicists or some cosmologists we've also been working with. You can simulate lattice gauge theories. Optimization, perhaps more for industry. Again, what Maddie was talking about, the core idea being that you can very nicely encode graphs in this neutral atom architecture and use the system to extract properties of that graph, such as the prime example really being this maximum independent set problem. But we're also working on others, maximum clique, vertex cover, minimum dominating set, graph colorings, and also the cubal formalism. Not quite there yet, but it's coming soon. And finally, also relevant for the people in the room, we've gotten started on machine learning. Personally, I don't know too much about this field, but yeah, I guess, again, the machine is out there, so you can go and implement your ideas, the ideas we've heard over the past couple of days, on the machine. And to finish off this slide, just a few more key words for the algorithmic range we have. We have various adiabatic protocols. I mentioned quench dynamics, lots of variational algorithms, QoA, quantum sampling, this kind of stuff. A few more words about Quera as a company. We don't just work on hardware, we don't just work on software or algorithms, but we have 40 people working on all three of those levels, so it's really a full stack company. The algorithms, or our algorithms team is, you know, like our in-house research department. They work a lot in cooperation with research groups at various universities, national labs, government agencies, and companies. Then we have the software team, including, or linked to, let's say, the scientific software team that I'm also part of. Our main responsibility is building Blockade. That's an open source platform mainly for simulation currently of the machine, really running and testing the hardware. As you can imagine, that's quite important in the current phase. And at the bottom of the stack, of course, the hardware is at the heart of the company. Okay, that being said, now some more actual physics. How does this neutral atom processor work? Of course, the atoms are super important, but there's a second key ingredient, and those are lasers. The first thing we do with those lasers is we shine them at the positions where we want the atoms to be located, and then we load a gas of atoms into that box, and get ready, with a 50% roughly likelihood, those atoms will get trapped in that optical trap. So far, so good. Now we want to store some quantum information, so we'll choose a ground state and an excited state as our 0 and our 1. And then the next set of lasers comes in, namely the so-called Rabi drive. And the Rabi drive just induces Rabi oscillations between those two levels. In other words, it's kind of what puts the atom into superposition. In the Hamiltonian, that's like the sigma X term. But what's so special about this excited state, these Rydberg states that everyone talks about? Well, maybe I'll go back, play the simulation once more. You can see they're huge, these Rydberg states. For us, that's the N equals 70 state of a rubidium atom. And that means that these electrons are very far out. So they are very sensitive to other electrons that might be in that state. However, that phenomenon is very distance dependent. So let's say you had two atoms that are quite far apart. Then it's no problem to excite both of those atoms into this excited Rydberg state. But if we move them closer together, then something different happens. Namely, they become conditional on each other. If you excite one, you're not really going to excite the other, and vice versa. So that's what we mean with entanglement through this Rydberg blockade effect. That's the Hamiltonian that you've also already seen once yesterday. The phenomenon I just mentioned, right? That's this term right here, the interaction. The van der Waals term falls off as r to the 6. So it's very nice. We have strong interactions, but you can turn them on and off by moving the atoms inside or outside of this blockade radius. Then we have this middle term that we discussed, the Rabi drive with the superposition. And finally, we have this detuning term at the end. You can basically think of that as a chemical potential. And to give an example of how you would use it, let's say you are a condensed matter physicist and you want to prepare a ground state, then you would keep the omega constant to have those Rabi oscillations. You start off with a large negative detuning term so that all atoms are in the ground state, and you ramp the detuning up to a large positive term. And then depending on the ratio of the Rydberg blockade radius to the separation of the atoms, you will end up in a Z2 or a Z3 or some ordered state of matter. Right, so maybe, actually let me go back once to this slide, because there was this word hiding up here in the left corner that I didn't explain. What do we actually mean by this analog mode? Computers in general, not just quantum computers, they have two modes of operation, analog versus digital. And so most of you are probably more familiar with the digital mode on the right-hand side. What does it mean? What does a circuit typically look like? You have one or two qubit gates. Yeah, I mean, it's the typical picture, nothing special. And yeah, that picture up there is just supposed to show that, yeah, we're addressing one or two atoms. And the easiest way to picture the analog case is we're simply applying one big multi-qubit gate. We're acting on all the atoms at once, entangling them all together. And what is that unitary going to be? Well, we're just, in other words, time evolving under the Hamiltonian we just saw. That's really what we mean with analog versus digital mode. Now you might ask, why do we do this? Well, there are two main advantages. Firstly, it's more robust to errors. You've probably heard, right? Digital mode, quantum error correction, big topic. This is very good in the current stage where we're not quite ready for error correction yet. And it's also quite easy to control in the lab. However, it is not a universal mode of computation. But that's no problem, because even though it's not universal, it's still very powerful for some problems. So here are some examples. On the left-hand side, that's basically the 2D version of what I said before with preparing these Z2s and 3s and 4 ordered phases of matter. You can have checkerboard phases, star phases, strided phases, perhaps rhombic phases. perhaps controversial. Then on the far right, in more like the topological paradigm, what we said before, you can prepare quantum spin liquids. And in the middle, this was also very interesting, more to do with dynamics, quantum many-body scars. Those were actually discovered, I believe, on these Rydberg processors. And again, optimization, that's also a very good class of problems, specifically for analog computation. So we've ticked off analog. What about this FPQA thing? For those of you who are familiar, we're playing off of the idea of FPGAs, field programmable gate arrays. What we really want to emphasize with this word is one of the main advantages of this neutral atom architecture, namely that you can literally move the atoms around. They're highly reconfigurable. If you're really trying to sell the point, you could say you can with every measurement and then reconfiguration, build your new quantum computer just like that. You can contrast that perhaps with superconducting chips. I don't work with chips, but I mean the idea is simple. You have to go to a clean room and build the chip, and the qubits, they are fixed in those positions that you specified in the clean room. That's not the case with atoms. You can move them into all kinds of positions. Be it your vanilla square lattice, or perhaps you're interested in a Kagome lattice, you can do that. Or perhaps you don't need the 256 atoms, maybe you're interested in a smaller problem, but you want better experimental statistics. So you can just rearrange the atoms in something that looks like this, and then you basically times your number of experiments times 6. It's also good to keep in mind if you really want to go and run some tasks, you have to pay by shot number. If you do this trick, then you get more value, I guess. Some more examples. Let's say you were a global logistics company, then you could arrange them in a world map. And these are literally images of the atoms, I should say. You can literally do this. Or an example we presented in a webinar recently. Let's say you're in the city of Boston, you're, let's say, Tesla, you want to know, where do I put my electric charging stations? I don't want them to be too far apart. I want wherever I am in the city to be quite close to a charging station, but I also don't want them to be too close to each other, because that's kind of a waste of charging stations. Well, figure out what the possible positions are and put your atoms in those red dots. And then find the maximum independent set. So a lot of cool advantages. This GIF unfortunately isn't working. In their free time, our experimentalists, they love making all kinds of GIFs. So this was like a Hello World example of moving the atoms around in real time. And we could talk about more advantages and disadvantages of these neutral atoms versus superconducting, trapped ion architectures, etc. But really, the FPQA reconfigurability idea is the main thing. And that allows for exotic geometries, easy encoding of algorithms, and quick testing. But now, back to the main message. I really hope that, you go out there after this talk and try out the machine. So how do you do that? It's really a three-step simple recipe. Step one, you specify the qubit geometry. You have control of that. You can tell the machine where you would like the atoms to be. Step two, you specify the waveforms. Like we said before, maybe you want a detuning round. That's what's depicted right here to prepare one of those ground states. And step three, just literally write device.run and you get the data, you can analyze it. And this QR code right here will take you to a notebook that will walk you through all of those steps. And in particular, that notebook will take you to this interface. Because you might be asking, how do I actually access the machine? The machine is on the cloud. And for a bit of context, currently there are two main ways of doing this cloud access. Some companies, they have their own cloud infrastructure, and Qwera is also working towards that. But until we get there, like other companies, we've partnered with Amazon. Indeed, Amazon. I was surprised at first when I heard this, but they are in this business as well. And if you log in, then you'll see this list, if you go under devices, of all kinds of different architectures. So let's say you have IonQ. I think, is Cyan still here? No? Okay, she's working with IonQ, so if you had some questions about trapped ions, she'd be the person to talk to. In any case, we've got trapped ions, we've got Oxford Quantum Circuits and Rigetti here with superconducting chips, and we've got Qwera with the first neutral atom quantum processor. And also the only company doing this analog mode right now. And maybe let me just emphasize one thing. As Maddie said, neutral atoms are kind of the dark horse. They haven't existed for that long, but they're definitely up and coming. So right now there are six companies worldwide building this technology across the globe. Names you might hear are Cold Quanta, Atom Computing, M-squared even, Pascal, and Planck, I think, in Germany. And they're great companies for sure, but right now, if you want to go and access one, Qwera is the only one with an actual machine on the cloud. We've heard some stuff about Pascal, but we don't know where they're at. So Qwera is the way to go right now if you want neutral atoms. Ooh. Probably just wants me to stay here so everyone scans the QR code. What's happening now? When that time, you can go ahead and scan the QR code if you want. let's see. Wonderful. Okay. Yeah, I thought I'd put in one slide on blockade since that is the project the team I'm working with. The first thing it's for is indeed benchmarking Aquila. That's very important right now because we haven't had these machines for long, so you need to know whether the thing is working. So for example, I'm implementing some quantum Monte Carlo in blockade. On that note, also big shout out to the Pickle, including eJazz especially. I'm basically just taking his good code and polishing it and documenting it and writing tutorials to make it useful for more people. We're also working towards programming the machine using blockade. And of course, it's just a learning platform as well with many tutorials and documentation. And yeah, scan this QR code too if you want. Finally, what about that modular architecture I mentioned? Well, we're not just going to stick with things like analog computing. We are also moving towards digital modes, hybrid computing, all kinds of things. And we want to do that without having to rebuild the machine. So that's the idea of modularity. You take the same machine and you can add loads of features to it. next to also building other machines, it should be said. So what kinds of features would that be? First, here in the middle, local detuning. If we think back to that Hamiltonian, the delta had a had an I on it in the sum, right? So you're supposed to give a different detuning to the different atoms. It's currently not yet possible, but will soon that will soon be the case, and that will open up the gateway towards many more Hamiltonians to study. On a similar note, local control of other parameters is also something we're working towards, and that will slowly move us towards gate-based computation. And with gate-based come a couple of more things, such as memory zones. So like you'll have, you know, one area of sites where you actually compute with the atoms, and then you move them over to a memory zone where you just store them, you know, have to keep the information, then you move them back if you want to compute further with them, this type of stuff. And finally, error correction. That's a big goal coming up in the digital mode. Yeah, I think that's pretty much everything I wanted to say. I hope you like the animations, and I really hope you go and try the machine out. If you end up having questions about how to program something or so, we're starting a series of office hours, the first one being next Monday at noon. And here, very important, on the right-hand side, you can also email Pedro, our kind of marketing guy. I mean, he's a postdoc level physicist, but has now switched over into, you know, more the outreach and support network surrounding Aquila. And he'll be happy to get you set up with a free runtime on the machine. Right? We have like our industry partners, but for academia, we've got some free runtime. Yeah, that's basically it. Thank you very much, and have fun programming.
Okay. Thanks, Anna. That was great. First question here. Hi. Thanks for the... on the slide before, where you... So all the plans, which time scale expect them?
So of course, you know, it's nothing definitive that I say, because in the lab you always run into unexpected things, but the local detuning is about to happen, so over the next month or two, something like this. And then digital mode, that's planned for next year. So we'll see the first gate-based algorithms for 2023.
That's pretty soon.
Yeah. I mean, no promises, right? But that's the plan for now.
Yeah, thanks for the amazing talk. So I have just two questions. So firstly, you talked about FPQA.
Yeah.
Essentially, so can we program like any configuration on like through bracket? Or is there any constraint, like on connectivity or?
There are some constraints, like, you know, minimum distance between the atoms, stuff like this. But they are well documented. So if you, like, literally, if you do something like device.capabilities, then it will print out, you know, all of these constraints. But as you can see here, you know, these are literally pictures taken of the atoms, so it is very, very reconfigurable. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the second question is not technical. So in the very beginning, you mentioned Aquila is a bit better than D-Wave, and with respect to coherence. So yeah. What other ways is it better?
Well, I would say that this analog mode of computation, or maybe I should say, you know, D-Wave, probably most people know, but focuses on annealing, right? And analog computation includes annealing. You can also do annealing, right? Probably the stuff I said reminded you of annealing, but it can do a lot more, you know, simply in terms of the algorithmic range that I kind of, there goes the presentation. Well, yeah, those algorithms, it just has a lot more to do. Ooh. Okay, yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Laptop crashed. Oi.
More questions?
Hi, very cool talk, thank you. I was wondering about scaling of the systems.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as I know, in ion trap quantum computers and superconducting, they maybe have problems to have everything on one chip or on one trap, and so need to build modular chips and connect them.
Yeah.
Is that the same here?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I just didn't put it in the talk because, you know, if you don't work yourself on a system, it's always hard to know exactly what they can do. But scalability, generally speaking, definitely is another big advantage of red-brick systems. Maybe just to expand a little bit, what Marie was mentioning, with the superconducting people, they seem to be having a big bottleneck coming up with respect to scaling, because if you have this chip, you know, the qubits are literally implemented with a circuit on that chip, and you control the circuit via control lines, like literally wires on the chip. And I think you need roughly like 3 per qubit or something. So now if you're building a 1,000 qubit chip, that means you need thousands of wires. But you need that chip to be in a cryogenic chamber. So it actually becomes a huge engineering challenge to have that chip with all these wires in this cooling system. Like, you get temperature leakages and so on. So it's a big engineering problem. It was interesting also being at a River Lane launch event in Boston. They built more, they call it quantum operating systems. But they also had a professor there speaking about, like, he's from a superconducting background, and he was saying, oh, we need to come away from thinking scalability is the, you know, the big goal. So I do get the impression it is a big problem for them. Also for trapped ions, I would be very curious to know how they are planning on scaling, because as far as I can tell, it doesn't look easy. The thing is, and I wish I had a picture right now, with the trapped ions, you have this 1D chain of ions, and they can all talk to each other. They also have very strong interactions. But the difference with the Rydberg system is that if you move the atoms outside of the Rydberg blockade radius, you turn the strong interactions off. That's a big plus. But so in the ion case, literally all the ions, they always talk to each other. So, fine, you have a lot of connectivity, you can let any ion talk to any ion, but if you shake one ion and another ion to implement a 2-qubit gate, well, all the ions, all the other ones, are also going to start shaking. So you somehow need to coordinate all this other shaking so that the ions you don't want to address cancel out in their motion. That's the picture I get. So I would be very curious to know how you scale that up, because it seems so complex. But with Rydberg systems, it is a lot easier to scale up. And I think in these associated academic labs, they've gone up to 1,000 atoms that they've trapped, at least. So scalability is a big plus.
One question here.
Thank you. I have a question about mapping an arbitrary. It a weighted graph. Then to map it to add some vertices, right?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I personally don't work on optimization, so I don't know the exact answer, but someone did ask about weighted graphs in our last webinar, and the response was that, very simply speaking, you will be able to do weighted graphs quite soon. So that's all I can say right now, but it should be possible to deal with those type of graphs.
More question?
Hey, good talk. So you mentioned in part of this that one of the applications users would be able to logged in to use the system were variational quantum algorithms.
Mm.
And my question was around how you code such a thing using an analog framework? Because I'm very accustomed to thinking quantum algorithms, programming them digitally with gates. Mm-hmm. So I imagine there's some sort of Hamiltonian you have to specify. Mm. But if I were going in to try and use it to implement an algorithm, mm. how would I, as the user, know how to specify it?
Mm. Mm. Again, not my area of expertise, but what I would imagine is that it probably interfaces with hybrid computing as well. Because, you know, if you have like some energy expectation value that you're using to do this variational algorithm, then that's pretty easy to do in this analog mode, right? Like you're using some Hamiltonian that you implement, and then probably use the expectation value to, you know, proceed with the algorithm.
Okay, interesting.
Probably, yeah. Oh, also, one thing I had forgotten to say, since I see Rob sitting at the back, I thought it was so funny that in the imaging of the atoms, of putting them in the right position, they also refer to this as holography. So, you know, something to learn, right? Other aspects of holography. Yeah.
What was that?
Which factors do we need to consider for choosing the type of lattice? I mean, how do I know that I need to choose the square lattice of atoms or hexagonal, for example?
Hmm. Well, in the condensed matter case, I guess that the answer is quite clear, right? Like you're literally choosing the lattice that you want to study. In the optimization case, I don't know, to be honest, because that's not what I work on. So I hope the documentation is good. I mean, unfortunately, Galactica got shut down, right? So I can't write our documentation. We were even trying this. It was taking the documentation that already existed and like reworking it. But now we have to keep writing ourselves.
Maybe as one last dangerous question. You're an academic at, you know, the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, 3 months into your first industry internship, would you recommend the experience to the students in the audience? Was it a good experience working at industry?
It definitely is, because actually, I mean, they're all physicists in the company who kind of wanted to keep on doing what they did as grad students. So that's very much the feel of the place. Just like, you know, a big room, I mean, a couple more corridors, but like, you know, big room and just people walking around and very interactive, very much a startup feel still. You know, if someone has a problem, you just jump in and try to help out. And I mean, you learn a lot from the experimental side. You know, I can just, you know, if I have a code bug and I can't be bothered, you know, I just go over to the lab and say, hey, you know, what's this laser? So it's very cool. I would definitely recommend.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, there are no more questions. Let's thank Anna again.